Now, on the BBC World Service, DJ Joe Fletcher seeks out some of the forgotten recording artists of the American South in Southern Tracks. In this final episode of the series, he goes in search of family bands.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's certainly Delta's pleasure to welcome you to Houston. For your continuing comfort and safety, please remain seated with your seatbelt fastened until the aircraft is safely parked at the gate. Thank you for flying with us, and have a good day.
I've arrived in Houston, Texas, on the outskirts of the American South. It's huge, the fourth largest city in the country, and saying that it's spread out doesn't quite cover it. People from many cultural backgrounds live here, but it's not a town where you can walk down the street and meet people. If you want to meet anyone, you have to get in your car and drive. This is a track by the Meeks family, recorded over 40 years ago. They've been singing and playing together all of their lives. I collect records from thrift stores in the southern United States, dating back to the 60s and 70s, when thousands of amateur American musicians, largely Christian and often family groups, recorded their own songs for posterity and not very much money. So I decided to track down some of these family bands and find out why they did it and what's happened since. Hello. Good morning. How are you?
Good. Is this your first time here?
Yes.
Would you like some information on the church?
Certainly. We're here to meet the Meeks.
Oh, okay. I'll get you right in touch with them then.
Okay. Two of the family, siblings Randy and Cherry, now run the Lindale Assembly of God Church in downtown Houston. I'm not a churchgoer myself, but when I came across their record, I was attracted to the picture on the cover, a loving family group standing in front of their shiny trailer en route to a concert. And I wanted to hear more about their family story.
Hi. Morning.
Come on in.
How are you?
Good. Come on in, right in this room. I'm Randy's sister.
We've heard your voice, so it's lovely to put a face to it.
Thank you.
Cherry was only 8 years old when she recorded I've Got Confidence. Okay. 40 years later, she showed me into their office above the church, which was full of Meek family memorabilia.
Hello. Good morning. How are you?
Great. How are you, Joe?
Really well. This is amazing. You have your whole family musical history on the table in front of us. Yeah, I didn't realize you'd produced so many albums.
Were you able to explain everything on the table?
This is probably 1945 here. This was one of my father's family groups. And you see, there are five members of the family, including my mother and father, my father's two sisters and brother-in-law.
Musical families common in the South?
I think so. I think much of it was inspired by the community of the church and worshiping God. But certainly harmonies and family singing were quite common.
Wonderful. And when did you become the Meeks, as I know you as the Meeks? So with the two of you involved with your parents?
Well, I was born in 1952, and by the time I was 5 years old or so, they had me standing on a chair in church and singing in a church that my folks pastored. And then, of course, Cherry was born in 1960, and by the time she was four or five, she was singing on the platform with the family. My mother and dad always joked sometimes and said if nothing else was working, if you were able to either bring a monkey or a child to the act, well, then you had everybody. You had everyone's attention and everyone was entertained. And so sometimes Cherry or I kind of felt like the family monkeys early on, you know. But
I was the child and he was the monkey.
Well, I mean, the one that I have is the Roads to Jerusalem. Yeah,
New Jerusalem is where I'm bound.
Uh-huh. I found this in Georgia. And took it back with me because I just thought it was...
Did you find it in a store, a record store?
Yeah, or a thrift store.
Wow.
And I often collect family albums because the voices, they come together. It's very beautiful.
It is.
Oftentimes it's referred to as a family blend. Mm-hmm.
When we come together as family, it's almost like a sixth sense. You don't have to wonder where they're going to move or how they're going to make this transition musically. You just kind of know, and you just kind of all like just flow together.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. But yes, if you'd be able to describe the album cover.
Well, the album cover is full color front and back, and on one side it shows my parents and my sister Cherry standing together in front of the car and the trailer that they traveled in. And we traveled together. We would sing and preach and hold revivals all over the United States, Canada, and Mexico. So that's kind of the lifestyle of ministry that we lived in the late 60s and early 70s.
Well, have you heard the record? Because you have the records here.
Yes.
So,
okay.
Where are we? Track four.
Okay. I remember the first time I sang publicly, was very scared. I remember sitting in my mother's lap in the front seat of the car. We were on our way to a service, and I said, I just can't do it. I'm so scared, Mom. I don't want to do it. And all she kept saying was, just get up there and belt it out. That's all you got to do is just belt it out. And it, in my mind, I can remember interpreting that as, well, it doesn't matter if it sounds good as long as it's loud.
When trouble is in my way, I can't tell the night from day.
The first time I sang, I was on a chair, on a phone book, with a 44 microphone in front of my face, pretty much covering my whole face. And so I kind of hid behind the mic. It was not as scary as I thought it would be, and that's where it all started. You know, to listen to this recording kind of sounds like little Michael Jackson being backed up by the Meeks family. But it brought back a lot of memories, a lot of wonderful opportunities that our parents afforded us that maybe at the time we didn't acknowledge how much they were actually ushering into our life.
And of course, our parents have been gone respectively. My father's been gone for 20 years now, and my mother about 10 years ago passed on. And of course, Cherry and I are working together here in the church in Houston. Awesome. And we have quite an extensive music ministry that Cherry is the worship leader of. And so we're very, very thrilled and privileged still to be together.
Absolutely. But for the grace of God and the direction of our parents and the calling of the Lord on their lives, we would not be here today. So we do credit everything that we've been able to accomplish to the Lord and to our parents. So it's been awesome.
Family band records are very common in the southern states of America. The album covers often show the whole family wearing matching outfits. I have hundreds of these in my American collection. This next one is by the Thrasher Brothers. Their record sleeve has them wearing identical green silk suits and standing on top of their tour bus. They were on the road so much, they ended up establishing their own highly successful bus company in Birmingham, Alabama. And that's where I met brothers Jim and Buddy.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Jim.
Nice to see you. Glad
Buddy,
to have
I'm Joe.
You.
Lovely to meet you.
Joe? Well, it's Fantastic. Good to have y'all. Appreciate you coming
We're
in.
We're very happy to be here.
Let's go out in the lobby for a short This is the Hall of Fame of the Thrasher Brothers in our office here in Birmingham, Alabama.
Fantastic. So much memorabilia.
Yeah, we got lots of that. This is our mother. And this is Brother Joe and myself, and there's Brother Jim. And I think we were probably, 6, 8, and 10 years old?
Yep, absolutely, 6, 8, and 10 years old.
Let me tell you, when we first started, Mother decided that she wanted us to do a concert. So she said, well, how are we going to get the word out? Well, my uncle put a big old speaker on top of his car and went through the community talking about the Thrasher Brothers were doing a concert at Fruithurst High School. We got up there and did, I think Mother said, an hour and 10-minute program. Everybody loved it, and it just grew from that.
Now, over here on the other side, if you look over here, this is 1953. We were on the Ted Mack Amateur Hour, which was on NBC TV. He came to Birmingham, brought his show, and we auditioned for the show. Out of 200 acts in Alabama, we won the right to go to New York. That's the picture that we boarded an Eastern Airlines plane, Super Constellation, going to New York City.
This is interesting because, I mean, today we know of, you know, America's Got Talent or American Idol and things like this.
But we were on the first show where they called in and voted. They called in and voted for us, and we won that show in New York City. Then we traveled for a couple of years with the Ted Mack show, mainly on the weekends because we were still in school.
And so you're what, I mean, you're sort of teenagers here,
yeah,
young teenagers.
Right, 16, 14, and 12.
That must have been an amazing experience.
Well, it was
see
amazing.
America at that age.
It was. And our first trip to New York City, our first time to fly on a plane, was quite an experience for our entire family. But we had a great time in New York. It snowed a little bit. It was in November. Mm-hmm. And that was new to us because it doesn't snow that much here in Alabama.
So that's kind of how we got started. Later on, our dad drove the bus for us, and here he is getting an award from Continental Trailways
for safe driving.
It's amazing to me. I mean, when I found the records, it was the Thrasher Brothers.
Right.
And the more and more I talk to you and find out, the whole family was on that bus with you.
Absolutely. And of course, that was our home away from home because you finish up in Indianapolis, the next night you're in Detroit. So after the show in Indianapolis, you get on the bus, you relax and have a bite to eat. Then everybody goes back to their private bunks and goes to bed. And the bus starts moving on towards Detroit or wherever we're going. And Dad got us safely over. We traveled around 100 to 125,000 miles a year in that bus.
And, we did go professional and went as far as we could go, you know, until we got tired and wanted to leave the road.
We did some 52 recordings, records while we were during our career.
52?
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is my connection from finding your records. I have a couple, but I found one in Texas, and I found one in Georgia. So this is the record, the Thrasher Brothers, Riding High, and you're standing on top of your tour bus.
Right.
With the Thrasher Brothers emblazoned on the side. And I can just imagine it sort of driving at 70 miles an hour through the nights of the American highways getting you to the next concert.
Wow.
And I was always I loved the music, and I mean, you guys on the bus is fantastic.
Well, this was our first tour bus, as a matter of fact, the very first one. And as you can see, we were all very pleased.
Joe's on two.
No, let me see what Joe's doing here. Hey, all right. Joe's on line two. And we can put the old speakerphone here and do a little talk with him. We get all three of us. And Joe was the lead singer, so he had a very big part of the group. He sung the lead, I sung the tenor, and Buddy sung the baritone. Hey, Joe.
Hello. This is Joe.
Hi, Joe. This is Joe as well. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. I believe I can remember that.
Good.
Joe brought in from an album called Riding High, where we're standing on top of the bus.
Wow. That goes back a long time, for sure.
Do you remember any of the songs?
We can do The Rainbow of Love. You know, it was written by Marion Easterling here in Alabama. Try that, Joe. Let's see. Shining every day, all along the way.
There's a rainbow.
There's a rainbow of love.
Even just a small sample.
Amazing. You seem like such a close and tight family. What is the secret to having such a strong family?
The way that we've been able to stay together as a strong unit is just being honest with each other. If I had something against Jim, I tell him, hey, that's, you can't beat it. That's the way we've been able to to make it. You know, a lot of families, you get splits. But we discussed it, got it out of the way, and went on to the next thing. And that was it, you know.
Our mother, years later, my dad was driving our tour bus, and we were traveling all over the United States doing concerts every night. Our mother said, "Boys, I didn't mean for y'all to make a living doing this. I just wanted you to sing as little boys." I said, "Mother, you started, and we carried it on, and we're having a ball."
The Meeks and the Thrasher brothers both came from strong families, which encouraged their musical talent. But the following record in my collection was made by a group of young people with special needs, many of whom weren't raised by their families, but were brought up in a state care home in Mahia, Texas. I was interested to find out where they found the confidence to sing in public. So I got in my car and traveled west. Following a small winding road, very pastoral land, thistles and colorful flowers all around, and I'm entering the Mahia State Supported Living Center, where in the 1960s, a band called the Sunshine Singers, made up of people with special needs at the school, recorded a couple of albums, one of which I have. And we're here to find out what they're doing today and if any of the band members are still here.
Come on in, we'll sit you up in here and get everybody going with you, okay? I'll introduce you to some of them, okay?
Yes, I'm Ada Connor. And I was the pianist and trainer for these kids when these albums were made. And I taught them music through codes. I'd use green Crayolas, I'd use yellow, and then I'd use red for them to know that you pause or that you stop here. And they really learned to do that from there. You know, really, and that was 1968.
Okay, shall we have a listen to some of the record?
Sure.
I don't know if you guys have heard it in a while. But one of our favorite is Sitting on the Dock of the Bay by Thornton. But there's also Hello World, which is a beautiful one. That was so nice. There seemed to be a lot of emotions listening to that. Okay. Ada, what did that remind you of?
Well, I guess I was the person that taught that song when they did the recording. And I guess because that song was, even though it sounds simple, it was very difficult. So by the time we finished it was just a feeling of accomplishment.
It was incredibly ambitious to organize a choir with lots of different people with lots of different problems. Do you think you were quite pioneering in this?
Yes, very much so. I think that's the thing I enjoyed so much, because I'd always played for church groups. But I loved it because these kids were special. Because of the challenge it was, the results of what they did was such an inspiration. And to think that those are my kids from Mahia State School, you know what I mean? It was just really overflowing. You know, it was really, really wonderful. Because most people didn't think that they would be able to do that. I don't think there were any other choirs. Mm-hmm. There were no other choirs at the State Institution. You know, we were it. We were the beginning of the it, you know.
I'm just going to play Sitting on the Dock of the Bay. And it's track.
Sitting in the morning sun, I'll be sitting when the evening comes.
My favorite track on the album is Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, which takes a familiar song and gives it new life. It was recorded in 1961 by the Sunshine Singers with Thornton Chisholm as the lead vocalist. He now lives in Mississippi, a couple of days' drive from the school in Texas. And having heard some of his story, I really wanted to meet him.
You must be Thornton.
I'm Thornton.
Real pleasure to meet you, sir.
You too.
How are you?
Thornton is now married to Audrey, who was also in the Sunshine Singers, and sang with him on the record. They now live independently and have a family of their own. Unbelievably, they don't have a copy of their record and haven't seen it since they left the school.
I have the record here.
You do. Yeah, I don't have my hair. Where am I? I don't have my glasses.
You're on the back.
It's on the back.
Oh, yeah. There I am. Yeah, and there she is.
Beautiful.
Yes, you got the record and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, what song was on here?
Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Yes.
And Hello World.
Yeah. Hello World, yes. Yes. Old Pictures.
Yes.
Yes. That's W.B. Hammond right there. Reverend, that's his wife.
Mm-hmm.
Them people right there are the ones that helped me in my life.
Got you guys started.
Mm-hmm. Brother and Mrs. Hammond took me in as being coming from a broken home and taught me how to play the guitar and how to love the Lord and how to love music.
What did your experience at Maher and being part of the Sunshine Singers give you?
Well, for me, being there at Maher State School, the Sunshine Singers, I used to be shy to sing. It gave me confidence, you know, to stand before people and sing, and it taught me how to believe in myself, you know, and I can do this, you know, I can do this. Instead of, I used to think of myself, I used to think of my mind. Ain't nobody gonna really like to hear me sing or, you know, really want to see me because, you know, they look at me, they already know here at the school is for the retarded, and they already know that this person here is not gonna amount to anything, you know. But the thing at the school taught me how to be confident. Hey, that's how I am where I am today.
Joe Fletcher continues his journey through the deep American South after the news.
The BBC World Service.
Record collector Joe Fletcher is back in the USA.
I collect records from thrift stores in the southern United States.
Wow.
Dating back to the 60s and 70s.
It was slightly unusual at the time.
When thousands of amateur American musicians.
This is the Hall of Fame.
Largely Christian.
Tried to put the sermon in music.
And often family groups.
They had me standing on a chair in church and singing.
Recorded their own songs for posterity.
It was almost like a dream.
And not very much money.
Just get up there and belt it out.
So I decided to track down some of these family bands and find out why they did it.
It's almost like a sixth sense.
And what's happened since?
Our mother said, boys, I didn't need y'all to make a living doing this. I just wanted to sing as little boys.
Southern Tracks.
I couldn't believe that anyone had heard that album.
Online at bbcworldservice.com.
After the news, DJ and record collector Joe Fletcher continues his journey through the American South, tracking down people who, decades ago, made their mark by paying a few hundred dollars to produce a vinyl record. Joe takes a musical road trip through a lesser-known part of the world's most powerful country and finds that in America's Deep South, there's a great capacity for new beginnings. That's the final part of Southern Tracks, coming up in 2 minutes.
BBC News, I'm John Shea. A former Prime Minister of Pakistan, Nawaz Sharif, has claimed victory in an election that looks likely to put him in charge of the country for a third time. Unofficial results suggest his Muslim League will be the biggest party after Saturday's vote, but will need to form a coalition. Mr. Sharif promised change and called on other parties to join him in tackling the huge challenges facing Pakistan. The government of Taiwan has given the Philippines 72 hours to apologise for the death of a Taiwanese fisherman whose vessel was fired on by the Philippines Coast Guard. Taiwan is demanding compensation and the arrest of those responsible. It's also increased its naval patrols in waters near the Philippines. China is marking the fifth anniversary of one of the most destructive earthquakes ever recorded. Up to 90,000 people were killed in the southwestern province of Sichuan. Pope Francis has proclaimed his first saints in a ceremony at the Vatican. They include 800 victims of an atrocity carried out by Ottoman soldiers in the 15th century. They were beheaded in the southern Italian town of Otranto after refusing to convert to Islam. The Philippine government says that four of its peacekeepers who were abducted by Syrian rebels a week ago have been released. The Filipinos had been operating as United Nations peacekeepers in the zone separating Syria and the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. They're reported to have been transferred to Israel. Bulgarians are voting in a parliamentary election as the country faces a major economic and social crisis. Street protests over poverty and corruption forced the previous government of the centre-right GERB party to resign in February. And scientists in England have developed a new type of wheat, which they hope could increase production by almost a third. Researchers combined an ancient ancestor of wheat with a more modern variety to produce a new strain. BBC News.
Now Joe Fletcher continues his journey seeking out some of the forgotten recording artists of the American South in the final part of Southern Tracks.
This piece of music was composed by Ned Batista and is called Morning Prayer with Jazz. It was commissioned by the pastor of St. James's Episcopalian Church in Houston, Texas, for one of his services and recorded live. Nothing unusual about that, but this was 1961 in the conservative state of Texas, and the style of music provoked quite a reaction.
I didn't see the letters myself, but I was told that there were a considerable number of negative letters. Most of them centered on the fact that they thought that jazz in a church was just blasphemous, because they associated jazz with questionable morality, nightclubs, drinking, etc. And, I mean, the church was a sacred place, and they didn't consider that jazz was anything sacred.
Ned Batista didn't know it at the time, but this piece of music had started something new, planting the seed of an idea which was to come to fruition over 30 years later. I'm a DJ and record collector. I'm fascinated by the unusual records which can be found in thrift stores in the southern states of America. In this series, I've been tracking down some of these musicians to find out why they recorded their albums and to hear what has happened since. I found Ned's record, Morning Prayer with Jazz, in Texas, and it struck me as an unusual project. So I asked him to meet me back at the site of the original 50-year-old recording.
I'm standing in the Church of St. James, where morning jazz prayer was recorded in front of a live and participating congregation. And I can see that there's a bandstand set up in the right-hand corner. It's a very open space, reminds me of a cathedral in England in a way, a modern version. But they have a pipe organ at the end and a pulpit with the congregation, which is predominantly African-American.
So, it's time to go. We're on to the jazz service. Thank you.
And just as I was wondering how I'd recognize Ned Batista, he spotted me holding the same record he had in his hand. On its front was a faded blue picture of a jazz ensemble in front of an altar. Ned?
Yes,
I'm Joe.
It's a pleasure.
Really nice to meet you. Your copy looks like it's better condition than mine.
It probably is. I couldn't believe that anyone had heard that album. When Joe called me, it was almost like a dream. I said, I haven't thought about that for I don't know how many years. And I was totally taken aback when you called me. And he said he picked it up in a thrift shop in Dallas.
I've been traveling around the South collecting records from thrift stores, and the interest is to find the slightly more obscure records. You know, obviously there has to be something within it which is inspiring in a way, and then it's finding the musician behind it and finding out the story, what's happened in the interim. That's, you know, 1961, so we're talking 50 years. Would you be able to explain why it was produced?
In 1961, I was approached by a member of the clergy at St. James Episcopal Church, and this gentleman asked me if I would take part in a jazz service at the church. He needed three compositions, basically, and he wanted them to be contemporary jazz. I was a trumpet player at the time and a composer, and I composed the service for St. James. And the rhythm section accompanied all the prayers of the service.
Page 426.
I think it was produced solely for the, as a souvenir for the congregation that came to the service. It was not released commercially.
So the initial idea, which you were behind, came into flack and...
It was slightly unusual at the time, and what we did received a bit of publicity, and it turned out to be somewhat controversial. The church was flooded with letters, most of them rather negative, because people felt that church was not a place for jazz music at that time.
St. James's Church was blown down in a tornado not long after the Mass was performed, and jazz masses were not accepted there for another 30 years. One of the highlights of this trip was a moment which shed new light on the South. I witnessed something that was controversial 50 years ago, today being embraced. I was standing in St. James's Episcopal Church and had the pleasure of seeing two generations of musicians come together.
I am Sam Dinkins III.
Ned Batista.
I'm the director of the jazz ensemble, and I'm the drummer, right. Yep.
And whereas 50 years ago jazz was frowned upon in this part of the world, today a jazz mass is part of every Sunday service, and the musicians and congregation are both black and white.
So how long have you been carrying on this tradition here for?
It'll be 15 years in December. Yep. St. James, they didn't really take too well to it at first. And this was 97. He did it 61, then I come along and do it in 97.
And were they similar issues that you faced or different?
I think what we experienced was the fact that the Episcopal churches use European and classical music. So anything that wasn't like that was not an Episcopal mass.
I guess this is a question of association. Jazz, in this country, the parentage of jazz has always been questioned because it was mostly black. This music came from the coast of West Africa. Slaves brought it here, and so, you know, you see the general problem that we had in this country from the beginning, that people perceived this, and it took a long time. Now it's almost like chamber music.
Yeah.
Well, I guess there are two aspects with this album. It's the aspect of sort of trying to integrate race here in Houston, but then there's also the integration of the sort of musical styles, I guess. Ned, you've heard this record before, but it would be nice to hear again. Do you want to hear some of the actual mass with the jazz?
I'd like to. I really would.
And Ned plays trumpet on it, and he gave himself the opening, which is beautiful.
Wow. I'm looking forward to this.
Thank you.
Wow. I mean, hey man, you really just that call, that first part. I mean, I was getting really choked up. I mean, it's just the first couple of notes when I just you can hear that and you're gonna know it's the truth. It's the real deal. This is the real deal.
This is what we were all into at the time.
It's basically bebop jazz. It's very simple. Very simple beginning of this idea that you have obviously developed. What I heard today was highly diverse compared to this, and it pertained exactly to what's going on in the service itself, which is remarkably astute and I think great. And it seems to have, you know, it has an exuberance about it that I think make people get into the service and the spirit a bit more. Nothing against the traditional organ hymns, etc., but that's something that has been done many, many, many years, and this is quite different.
I have thousands of LPs by small-time musicians like Ned, which I've collected in thrift stores or charity shops in the American South. Family records, gospel bands, Christian kid records, preacher albums, and testimonials from people who have been saved. New beginnings seems to be a strong theme reflected in these albums. Many of these musicians have wrestled with addiction or ill health, and having a record was a way of showing they had started over. I find their albums fascinating, and over the years driving around the South, I have stopped at hundreds of thrift stores to sift through the tattered piles of LPs, hoping to find new stories of transformation.
Hi, I'm Jim.
Jim? Yeah. I'm Joe.
Glad to meet you, Joe.
I've arrived at the Good Shepherd Mission thrift store, a large warehouse stuffed with junk behind an old wooden white house where a daily soup kitchen feeds the have-nots of the local area. This is one of my favorite stores in the South, and it's where I have discovered many wonderful records over the years. I've never understood why it happens here, but you always find an incredibly diverse collection of records. Last time I was here, I found a collection of Senegalese records and a collection of Brazilian records, Caetano Veloso, Gal Costa, and so forth. And you just wonder how they appear here in the middle of Texas. Found a wonderful album. Oh, Noel Coward. There you go. Looking dashing in a bathrobe in the Alps. Found one here by Ima Sumac, the Peruvian sun goddess from the 1950s, who was the most incredible singer. She had a 5-octave range. And some people thought that her real name was Amy Camus, which is her name backwards, and that she was an Irish housewife from suburban New Jersey. It was just pretending to be a Peruvian sun goddess. It's a mystery, but she was a wonderful performer. So to me, the joy of something like this is, I guess, the story behind the record and its journey to me. One of the records that I found here is called Amen, and is by the ventriloquist Beverly Massagy. In 1963, Beverly Massagy witnessed the assassination of her hero, President Kennedy.
I was raised in a very staunch Democratic family, and I loved the Kennedys, and I wanted to see them. He was my idol, and I wanted to get pictures of the president, and made it a priority to make sure I got down there that day. But unfortunately, I got there too close and was only about 20 feet from him when he was shot. It's a horrific day. It was a horrendous, horrible thing to go through as a 17-year-old child. And if there is one day in my life that I could change and go back and redo it and fix it, it would be November the 22nd, 1963.
Her life then spiraled out of control, resulting in a violent marriage and heroin addiction.
The pain, I could not deal with the pain in my life. I was in deep despair because I was lonely, I was empty. I actually had nothing to live for. And I'd never been in a Baptist church in my life, and I'm not saying that's the only place you can find Christ, it just happens to be where I found him. I had no intentions of going to church that night, but something like a magnet drew me to that church. And there was a man up there preaching, and he was telling me the most beautiful story I'd ever heard in my life. He was telling me about a God who loved me through all my sin and corruption. He loved me. And when I left that church house that night, I knew I was leaving a different person than the one that walked in there. I knew I finally had something that was the answer to all the emptiness and the darkness and the vileness that was in my life. God completely delivered me of drugs, and I praise his name every day.
And the heroin was cured?
Yes, at the time God saved me, he divinely, miraculously, instantaneously healed me and healed my body of the craving of any kind of drugs. And I've been free forever.
And you've had such an incredible life since.
Yes, I've had a glorious life since then.
Could we talk about meeting Charles?
Yes, I was singing at a convention, a Southern Baptist convention, and there was a man preaching that I thought was just about the best preacher that God I'd ever heard in my life. And we went out to a Christian friend's place for New Year's Eve, and the next day we went to the New Year's Day football game, and on February the 16th he asked me to marry him, and February the 18th I marched him down the aisle. That'll tell you what I think about long engagements. That I'd asked for God to send me a godly man, and he did. He sent me one who walks and talks with the Lord 24 hours a day, who preaches what he lives and lives what he preaches. And I was not going to take any chance of him getting away.
And would you talk a bit of the story behind Eric?
My husband, for years, did a program for the kids called Jewels for Jesus, and he's a fabulous magician. And it was a little magic show before church to build attendance for the kids. And the only requirement was they had to stay and hear him preach and hear me sing. Well, I could tell he was getting tired, a little worn out, because the first 3 years of our marriage, we did 42 meetings a year. And I could tell he was tired, and I just started praying for God to give me something that would still attract the kids, but without him having to do this every night. So I just started praying, and God laid ventriloquism on my heart, and he's been with us now for a long, long time. This is my friend. Some people refer to him as my other dummy. But his name is Eric, and Eric has been with me for 38 years. You're getting old. Yeah, I'm getting old, Eric.
All of the sort of the heartbreak that you've had in your life, has there been a very strong like bond and connection between you and Eric, the sort of the sense of him being on your knee?
Well, no, actually, my relationship with Eric is more, I live the childhood that I never had through him, because I started singing when I was 9 years old. Professionally, when I was nine. I was never really a child. I don't remember a lot about, I remember bits and pieces about my childhood, but it didn't last very long. And so I've lived my childhood vicariously through my other dummy.
He allows you to say things that you wouldn't.
Oh, yes. I can say all kinds of things through him that I'd never say myself. I don't have the guts to.
Hi, Eric.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm really well. How
very nice to meet you.
You're brilliant.
Thank you. You're kind of cute yourself. You want to hear something else I can do?
Yeah.
I lay a lady, lady, oh, hi, lady, a little lady, a little lady, a lady, lady, oh, hi, lady. Jesus, put a yodel in my soul.
Brilliant. Who taught him how to yodel?
I don't know. I don't yodel.
Just came out.
Yeah, I did it. I learned all by myself.
Now, you need to get back in your suitcase.
No, I don't want to get in the suitcase. It's a nice sunny day out here. I want to stay and play.
No, you've got to get in your suitcase.
I don't want to get in that suitcase. Wait a minute.
What?
I got to tell you something.
Well, tell me.
I got to whisper. We'll whisper it. No, in a minute. I got to go now. I don't want to get in that suitcase. No, don't put me in there. Somebody help me. I don't want in there.
Eric, stop it.
Help me. Okay. Now I got to get your mic out.
Oh, it's so nice to see Eric. He's still got it.
Yeah,
you've still got it as well.
Oh, thank you.
What would your advice be about starting over based on everything you've experienced in life?
Well, one of the most valuable lessons I think I've learned as a Christian, and if I could pass anything on to anybody, it would be this. Realizing that happiness is a choice. Every day you get up, you make a choice whether you're going to be happy or you're going to be mad. And a long time ago, I decided that life was either going to control me or I was going to control my life. And I chose to be happy and control my life.
Beverly's newfound faith saved her from trauma and heroin addiction. Stories about lives being saved are common amongst these amateur records, which were pressed here in the South in the 1960s and 70s. In a thrift store in Texas, I found another moving record, this one by gospel saxophonist Brother Vernard Johnson. On the cover is a picture of a young man in the prime of his life, raising his saxophone to heaven. The last track of the album is entitled Testimony and outlines the troubles life has thrown at him.
I want to tell you something. Something that might help young people everywhere. You see, about 6 years ago, I had a disease in my body, and many people don't believe this by listening to me play and by watching me play and listening to all the wind that I use, all the air that it takes. But I had bronchial asthma all down in my lungs. And it was so bad until my folks could be upstairs in the home and I could be across the hall and they couldn't even sleep at night for listening to me breathe.
Hi, I'm Dr. Vernard Johnson here in Kansas City, Kansas. I made this record around 1972. I was young and I was born with asthma. I couldn't breathe correctly to save my life. And my mother and my aunt who raised me, they prayed for me. And I was walking down the street and I had hit rock bottom in life. So I'd gotten on the wrong track. I sneak out the window at night and, you know, there's a lot of drinking, a lot of smoking, I'm sure a little drugs, stuff like that. And I just decided that, you know, I wanted more in life. And so walking down the street on 12th Street in Kansas City, I looked up to heaven and said, God, I've heard that you'd be a doctor in the sick room, a lawyer in the courtroom, and a bridge over troubled waters. And if you're truly real, I want you to take this asthma that I had all my life out of my lungs. And if you'll do it, I'll play for you the rest of my life. Well, God convicted me that my life was messed up more than my lungs. And on the street, I invited Christ into my life. And 2 weeks later, I had my horn playing Amazing Grace, and I never after that day had asthma anymore. So I had tremendous wind as I have now. I could blow a song and hold a note so long until people would just be amazed at how long I could hold a note. And then I gave my heart to Christ, and I wanted to make a record. And I wanted to just basically to bless the hearts of people. That's what it was all about, trying to help someone. And I tried to put the sermon in music on the record so that someone could hear it and their life might be changed. I want to just say also that it was incredible to realize that God was using me on a saxophone, the instrument that most people thought should never be used in the church. Now it was being used as an instrument of God.
In this series, I've met many people who overcame the problems life threw at them. For some, it was heartache, others, drugs, abuse, illness, or bereavement. Overwhelmingly, I've sensed that their endurance was aided by their geography, the healing power of the American South.
When Christ changed my life, I promised him that if he would bless me, I would blow for him the rest of my life. I've kept my promise. I've always blown for Christ, and I've always kept the promise of trying my best to use my horn to reach the lost for Christ through my horn.
Brother Vernard recorded his testimony when he was 27. He's now a minister, been inducted into the Gospel Hall of Fame, and has his own church, which he recently opened in Kansas City.
And that new beginning of playing the saxophone launched me into going to school and getting my doctorate degree in composition. And I am studying now expository preaching, so I'm putting the preaching with the blowing. A new beginning.
You've been listening to me, Joe Fletcher. Kim Normanton was my producer, and this was a Loftus production for the BBC World Service.
Thank you, Lord. Thank you.